Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And do you like the Statue of Liberty? Sure. Don't we all? Symbol of Liberty. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean for us? We're going to be looking at the Statue of Liberty through the eyes of a book called The Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World. And we're going to look at it in relationship to this year's election and understand what this Goddess of Liberty is doing for us and why perhaps this election is such a recognition of what it is to be a man and a woman historically in this world and coming into a new time, a new era, where perhaps we'll learn to get it right. And this book will certainly help, The Secret Life of Lady Liberty. So we're going to be talking with the authors, Robert Hieronymus and Laura Kortner, to talk about what does this all mean? We're at a strange time where our Statue of Liberty represents something that many ways seems to be at stake at this point in our history. What can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, as you know well, our nation is at an imbalance. The patriarchy that's reigned for the past 5,000 years is a major part of that imbalance. And we are moving once again, hopefully, towards balance. I'm not saying that both of the candidates, or either one of them, is in major balance, but it's our opinion, especially mine, that it is the rebirth of the divine feminine that can help us rebalance that. And when you look at the Statue of Liberty, the Statue of Liberty is all about balance. When you take a look at the Statue of Liberty and you see that in her right hand is that symbol of the torch, that torch, not that it sets a fire and causes revolution, but a torch or the flambeau which enlightens. She is holding enlightenment in her right hand. Symbols are extremely important in consciousness and the subconsciousness. And she contains so many symbols that tell the story of how to stay in balance. The right hand is the hand of the more masculine activity. The left hand, what's that left hand holding? It's holding a tablet. And that tablet has written on it, July 4th, 1776. It is kind of like her child. The Statue of Liberty is kind of like a mother to the world, because the Statue of Liberty is one of the most popular symbols in the entire world. Anywhere you go, most countries have a Statue of Liberty taken from us. So she's universal. That balance, okay, of course, being in the left hand, that balance of the inner life, which is the left hand, the inner life is the birth of a republic, a representative form of government.
All right, Bob, this sounds really good, and it's very ideal. But we're at a time where it needs to be understood, and the history of it needs to be understood in order to realize its importance, because the history is very flawed. This statue, to many people, was really a negative. It was seen as satanic to some people because it represented female power, and the woman, even at the beginning of our country here, when the colonists came here, they didn't respect the Indians at all because they respected women. And they thought that was terrible, that these Indians had nothing good about them because the women were the wise ones, that they respected.
Of course, you're right. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you read our book, because in it we put great emphasis upon the League of the Iroquois and exactly what they, as they were teachers to our founding fathers. Let me turn this over to my partner here. Laura, you want to go on?
Well, sure. Thank you, first of all, for having us on Energy Stew. Well,
I think
it's a great topic for the Statue of Liberty and how she's an energizing symbol. What we're trying to do is to remind people that she is a goddess. And you brought up the fear reaction that a lot of Americans have to that word goddess. But that's more a contemporary interpretation to call her satanic. And that's happening because the religious right and the paranoid conspiracy theorists are seeing her as an interpretation of a female divine, and that drives them crazy, because any idea of an empowered woman, a powerful woman, is therefore satanic, because they believe this creation story that man was the creator god and woman was created later as a helpmate, whereas in the indigenous cultures, as you pointed out, the Native Americans among them, but the older cultures amongst Europe as well, where they conceived of their god as a woman, you know, the sky woman that fell from the sky for the Iroquois traditions. And then her body later becomes the earth, her granddaughter, her mother, become the earth and the moon. And so they see the earth and the female as the same thing, and they revere their women as powerful. And yes, the colonials from Europe did pick out a lot of ideas from the Iroquois system when they were founding their government, but they completely ignored or didn't see that they had elevated their women to positions of power. The Council of the Clan Mothers amongst the Iroquois were on par with the Supreme Court, and they left that out when they were forming the American form of government. They picked up all these other things about representational democracy, and they by cutting out the women, they also cut out the earth. So reverence for the earth just was washed away. And so we've got this patriarchal domination power. But the Statue of Liberty is an energizing symbol. It wasn't started out as a symbol for immigration, which most people see it today. It was started out completely different, as inspiration for French people. And it's changed through centuries of being in existence because America has changed. And as a symbol for change, it can energize Americans. If we can embrace it as a goddess, we can recognize life as sacred, because we've adopted this unconsciously as our identity of America. America is identifying as a female divine figure,
well,
unconsciously.
Book,
so let's tap into that and allow it to rise through our consciousness.
And of course, it wasn't just the League of the Iroquois, but the Cherokees and other groups around the country. But since you've read our book, you understand that that's where we're coming from. We did not listen totally to the League of the Iroquois and their teachers. We threw out the whole idea of women were important in any way. If you ever heard of Benjamin Franklin's ideas about women, should shut up and get out of the way, even though he happens to be one of my favorite founding fathers. But as I was pointing out with symbols, because symbols are extremely important. I know you understand this aspect of it, because symbols especially are healing agents. They are significant forces in the psyche. My doctoral thesis was based on the symbolism of that, and they are a bridge between the conscious and the unconscious mind, and it cultivates wholeness, resulting in self-realization. And that literally, I didn't finish with the Statue of Liberty symbols, but we don't need to go back to that, but that the whole story of the Statue of Liberty are basically in its symbols. You know, she's standing on a chain, and that chain is basically the problem of being held back in elevating awareness and consciousness. Because she's got that crown on her head, she is elevated awareness. So symbols are extremely important.
What I loved about your book is that you go through the history, the evolution of the struggle of coming to these realizations through history, and how women have been symbolized in many different ways. They were symbolized in Greece, in ancient Greece. There was Athena, and then in Rome had Minerva, and there were so many different symbols. In the early days of our country, the Indian queen was a symbol. There were depictions of this Indian queen, And that was supposed to be powerful, but then they decided that it was too dangerous.
Yeah, we have pictures of all of these at our website, secretlifeofladyliberty.com. It's really a remarkable gallery, and the Indian Queen is one of my favorites. That's a very poorly chosen nickname for this image. It's because, of course, they weren't Indians. That was Columbus's mistake, and there were no queens. There was no royalty, at least not in the North American, Native American tribes. It was a misnomer. They saw a powerful woman, they automatically thought she must be royalty, but in fact, all women were powerful. So they, when they first discovered the continent on their maps that they were drawing of the new world, so to speak, they would depict, they allegorized women. That was one of the reasons that, one of the ways that they symbolized women. You were saying the female archetype is all about perfection, and I think it's a virtue, and a lot of these words are Latin feminine nouns, so they become depicted as women. So there was a female depicting Europe, there was a female figure depicting Asia, and there was a female figure depicting Africa. And then when they realized there was a fourth part of the world, they created a new one called America. And this was what we call the Indian Queen. She's this big, voluptuous, savage-looking woman, usually carrying a club, riding on an alligator or an enormous armadillo. It's obviously drawn by somebody who's never been here before. She's wearing feathers and tobacco leaf skirt. Usually she's mostly naked, and that's a really important part. That's how you identify her from the other three, because she's got very few clothes on. And that was done, probably unconsciously, as a sexual metaphor. They wrote, Vespucci even wrote about, the women were very sexually available, and they described the land as a virgin waiting to be ravished. And it just set up the whole paradigm of domination that the Europeans were so good at, and control. And it affected both the woman and the earth, because they, again, were one and the same. So then later on, the colonists, several hundred years later, they took that Indian queen and they melded her with Britannia, another female allegorical symbol, which was modeled off a little bit off of Minerva. She had the helmet and the shield. And they created a new one called the Indian Princess. She's sort of like the Indian Queen's younger sister or Britannia's rebellious teenage daughter. And this image was used by Paul Revere and Ben Franklin and all their mastheads for their rebellious newspapers, and encouraged the people to break apart and see themselves differently. It was the very first time that the colonials called themselves Americans. They had before only been referring to Native Americans as Americans, but now they became Americans too, based on this symbol that invited them to be a family. She and Britannia were often seen as part of a family, up against the king. The king was the king, and his ministers were the ones depicted as the bad guys, whereas the women and the women figures were the ones advising them to unify and become a new country and be their own people. So
well,
yeah,
there's
a lot
here.
Of depictions. Sorry, go ahead.
There's a dichotomy here, because this is a paternalistic society where women had no power, and yet they were used as symbols. And even now, the statuary of women, you have the Statue of Liberty, there's also the Statue of Freedom, the Statue of Justice. There's so many statues around all over the place that have to do with idealism, really.
Mm-hmm.
And yet,
yep.
So we're guided by this idealistic nature of divine feminine, and then try to subdue it as much as possible.
Yeah.
Well said. That's well said.
Yeah, I would just say the Statue of Liberty is one symbol that has more broken out from that put on a pedestal kind of approach to female allegory, which you're absolutely right. I think that in a lot of ways this depiction of women had kept women in their place even more than it helped empower them, because there's this virtuous role model that nobody can attain to and literally put up on a pedestal. But the Statue of Liberty, you know, the suffragists protested against her. I don't know if a lot of people know that. In 1886, when she was first debuted, they unveiled her at an official ceremony. And the suffragists in New York City, led by Lily Devereux Blake, a name that people should read in history but have never heard of mostly, a very effective journalist and author in her own right, she organized a trip out there and protested and said, this is a giant hypocrisy. Here you are erecting a giant woman standing for liberty in a land where women have no liberty. They pointed it out. They saw it right away for what it was. However, when they saw the veil fall from her face and it went on for half an hour, all these whistles and horns and explosions, everybody was cheering, she said that their eyes just filled with tears, and all of a sudden they saw her as a symbol for their future of liberty, or women, rather, liberty, that there are women liberty, they called her. And then around that same year, you know who's being born is Alice Paul. And if you don't know who Alice Paul is, everybody should know who Alice Paul is. Without her, the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote never would have happened. She's born in 1885, and some of her colleagues, Inez Mulholland, is born the same year as the Statue of Liberty is unveiled. So these women, around the turn of the century, as they're growing up and coming of age, become much more active and even militarized in their approach, and they started picketing outside the White House the first time it's ever been done. They dress up as the Statue of Liberty. I think, again, unconsciously, they were taking courage and being inspired by this giant woman liberty standing for a future that they saw for themselves someday for their grandchildren, that women would actually have liberty.
Your book talks about a lot of powerful women who most people have never heard of. I was very impressed with what you had to say about Mercy Otis Warren.
Oh, yeah.
And her relationships with powerful men at the time and helping them to find wisdom. And so what's interesting is your book really covers the evolution of women coming to power, including what happened during the wars that really showed that women had an important place in power, that these wars couldn't have been handled without the women doing their work. Mm-hmm. And that empowered them to find their own voice and realize they have a voice because they were needed so much.
Oh, they certainly were. They held our country together, even though George Washington had a couple of misfits about them, because as the armies moved through the nation, wasn't the nation then, but as the armies moved through the countryside, they carried with them at least thousands of families, of especially women, who would be the nurses and would also get in there and fight if they had to. The children were also coming along with chickens and everything else, so it was a moving tribe. But George Washington was very unhappy with it and didn't like it, and he wanted to somehow cut it back because they said they would get in the way of things. So his view of women was kind of similar to Benjamin Franklin, unfortunately.
But he also knew they were necessary. They were serving as the washerwomen and then the nurses and the spies. Washington used many of them as spies deliberately. And then there were some that dressed up, of course, and incognito fought in the war. But most importantly, women found their role. They found their voice during the revolution and the years leading up to it when it was happening in the mind. You mentioned Mercy Otis Warren. She was one. Abigail Adams is another one, famously, and they were friends for a while. Mercy was a very prickly sort of person, so I think a lot of people fell away from her in the end, but she was raised in a family unlike the norm. It was just starting with the Enlightenment, where fathers were starting to realize that their daughters might become educated along with their sons. And that's one of the most revolutionary things that the war did for women. After the war, these women had voiced their political opinion. They had participated in the boycotts. The patriots said, we can't do this without our women's consent. And I love some of those stories where the women would go down to the shop merchants who were hoarding the coffee. Abigail Adams writes a wonderful story about that, where 100 women went and they seized him by the neck, and all these men were watching across the street and just let it happen. And they just forcibly took over the coffee that he'd been hoarding and distributed amongst themselves and so on and so forth. So women before had never been allowed to have any voice, and certainly not in politics. But after the revolution, they were determined that the women had to become the teachers of the new patriots. So women, for the first time, were allowed to go to school. And female educational institutions sprouted up all over the new nation. And within 2 decades, I think the literacy rate just doubled and tripled. And that was the beginning of educating women. And, of course, liberty enlightening the world is all about wisdom and enlightenment and therefore education. And it's all tied into empowering women. Educate a woman.
Well let's talk about educated women and how threatening they are to society in the way that a woman running for president, it brings out a polarization. And then we have a man running for president who is a polarization. And yet you hear people say how much they hate Hillary. And nobody can explain it. You know, they hate her for, you know, for things that haven't been proven. They don't know, you know, why is there such hatred? And I think it's archetypal. I think it's the church. And they don't realize, people don't realize that they're caught in this archetype of anti-female power that is so frightened that it creates hate. And they don't realize how they're espousing that and identifying with it. Because
and how it's
so ingrained.
On mistranslation.
Yes, especially the extremists, down in there in Texas and elsewhere, where women, you know, there's so many women that die from not being able to reproduce correctly, Planned Parenthood being eliminated. It goes back to the Bible, where in women, women are the cause of the problem of everything, dealing with the first sins, et cetera. And they believe. Pardon me?
Yeah, that's why these fundamental religions, all of them, try to take every power they can away from women.
Absolutely.
Keep them disempowered, keep them pregnant, keep them poor, keep them unhealthy even.
Right.
Because heaven forbid they should be powerful if they're healthy enough.
Excellent point. That's true.
And I think you're right about the fear and mistrust of Hillary comes from a deep-seated, unconscious misogyny that we've been raised to accept and believe that women, especially powerful women, are not to be trusted because of the fall of Eve. It's that whole story that comes up. It's a story, you know? It's based on old Babylonian scriptures and where it's interpreted completely differently. You've got a male and a female and a tree and a snake, and it's generally seen as it's a goddess and her consort, and the tree and the snake are symbols of life and regeneration. But then the Hebrew scriptures, and much later into it when the judges are rewriting the Hebrew scriptures to show various excuses for what happened to them, and they were downplaying the insertion of the goddess in the Hebrew tradition. There was Asherah and Astarte and all kinds of goddesses that were the so-called wife of Yahweh, but we don't hear about that, certainly not in the fundamentalist Christian traditions. They don't want to know that there were male and female gods right there from the beginning. And in general, all the ancient cultures see the divinity as a gendered pair. It's just you're brought up that way. It's nature. There's male, female everywhere. It's only in our recent traditions where we've had one male god that has no female counterpoint. It just doesn't make sense in history. But that's the way we've been brought up, and that's the way we have our knee-jerk reaction. So therefore, women are equated with Satan. In divine power, anyway, and in divine women.
Well, we're at a time of evolution here, and that's what brings out the worst in things, so that we can see the truth. And and Donald Trump is the worst in things of male power and the degrading of women. And in every way that he sees women just as sexual objects is, you know, and then Hillary, on her side, is I don't think she's 100%. I think, you know, there's some things that need to change, and hopefully Bernie can help along those lines. But she does represent women coming to power. There's a film that that came out this summer that I'm in the film. It's called Run for Free. And it's a history of running in the world. And a lot of the film is a history of women's running and how women used to be considered too weak to be able to run in track races more than 200 yards. And it was only in the 1980s that women were actually allowed to run longer distances.
Wow.
And it's amazing, you know, where even in the early 1970s, Catherine Switzer was physically abused to try to knock her out of the Boston Marathon. Heaven forbid a woman should be in the race.
Yeah.
So it's a great film to understand how women have come into power. And
mentioning that. That's really, really good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah,
and that happens, of course, a little bit at a time. A little bit at a time, like any social movement. It happens when each of us makes one small decision in our life and makes a change and speaks up or changes a decision or a pattern or a habit. That's how social movements happen. They don't happen all at once. And I think that's what we're talking about here, the rise of the female divine, the power of the goddess. And that's men and women, men becoming more in tune with their so-called goddess side or their female divine side. And that's the type that honors intuition, that honors life-giving and caregiving and nurturing as strengths and as powerful and as necessary as the building blocks to a successful nation, a successful business, a successful family. You have to have healthy children who are educated and raised compassionately, and that requires women being given the ability, and men, to care for their families as well as to become leaders. And that's why we see the Statue of Liberty as an empowering symbol, because it's all about educating women and empowering choice.
And if you know, one of the
your
things...
book is very empowering. And people should really enjoy reading. I enjoyed reading it so much. I was just so caught in all the details that were so enlightening. The Secret Life of Lady Liberty. And you said there was a website that people can go to, right?
Right. It's the name of the book. The SecretLifeOfLadyLiberty.com.
And the gallery of illustrations is extraordinary, over 100 and some. Many not seen for years and years and years, and a bibliography. I love good bibliographies. We got a 17-page bibliography, and book that's in that bibliography was used in this book.
Yeah.
It's not like one of those hollow things. You can tell a lot about the quality of any work by checking out where your sources are. That's not done anymore, basically.
Your book is so educational. It's so educational. Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World. And I want to thank you, Robert Hieronymus and Laura Kortner, for being guests on Energy Stew. You've been wonderful, and I'm so happy with the work you're doing.
Well,
we're so happy to be on,
especially knowing the kind of work that you do, which brings people together in harmony on our planet.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you. There's a lot going on, heartriver.org. We have classes, all kinds of things going on. And thank you so much for listening.